We love to eat, most of us, and why not? We have to do it to live, so we might as well come with some. It might as well come with some pleasure. But the process of making good food can be daunting for a lot of people. Few of us will reach the heights of creation mapped out in works like the cookbooks of Julia Child, so maybe relaxing is in order. And that's part of the tone of a new work by Leanne Brown called Good Enough, a cookbook embracing the joys of imperfection and practicing self-care in the kitchen. Leanne Brown just wants people to eat well, no matter the budget. Her previous book, Good and Cheap, began as Leanne's master's capstone in food studies and went online for free. Leanne visited in August of 2015 to talk about that book. So, Leanne Brown, welcome back.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back.
It is a pleasure. You got me right at the dedication of this book, For Your Younger Self. Look, yeah. We did it. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I couldn't help but this book is so much for my, it really is for my younger self, both my very young self, my like 4 and 5 year old self, but also just for myself in my early 20s, all the times when I didn't feel like I was good enough and wasn't sure of what I could do. And I just felt really like I wanted to create something that would comfort that little girl and that young woman. At some point, that was so much of my motivation for writing the book.
Which all sounds triumphant, but then we get to the introduction of this book and you point out that you were quite down for an extended period.
Yeah, I struggled for sure. But you know what? We all struggle. And I think I really learned so much from, I've had many periods of depression. I've struggled with depression and anxiety all my life. And I was really surprised, actually, after my last book came out, I kind of went into another out of depression again, and I was really surprised by it because it felt like, gosh, I'm doing so well. I'm so thrilled to be doing what I love. I'm having success at it. Why am I having a hard time? Why am I feeling so unmotivated? And why do I feel kind of like a imposter all the time? And I realized that a lot of it had to do with just perfectionism and all these high standards of what I imagined, you know, a proper cookbook author should be doing all the time, and what, you know, a good person should be doing. And I kind of had to go deeply internal and do a lot of reflecting in order to kind of come out and write about the subject again. I think when Good and Cheap allowed me to meet so many wonderful people who shared their stories with me, but so often people would share that they felt like they were a bad cook. And I always thought that was interesting because usually they would be at like a cooking event and they would be coming up to me saying, you know, oh, I'm a bad cook. And I would ask them what they mean. And they'd say, oh, you know, my kid doesn't eat vegetables, or the meals that I make don't always turn out well. And I really relished the opportunity with these folks to say, what are you talking about? That doesn't make you a bad cook. You know, part of learning any skill is having mistakes and making mistakes. And nobody's kids like, you know, it's unusual for children really to like vegetables.
Right.
That's okay. My 4-year-old also can be difficult to feed, and that's just normal. And so I love to bring that comfort. And I realized that I also needed to do the same thing for myself because I recognized myself in so many of these conversations. And it was really only through learning, through working with myself and being compassionate with myself, that I really felt that I eventually like, had something to offer to others in the form of this book, in a form of, you know, thinking of cooking not just as it is something that we have to do every day, but the way that we often focus it on. It's like for example, a cooking class. When we think of a cooking class, you're going to go sign up for the sourdough making class, and it's like, the thing is saying, oh, we're going to teach you how to make the perfect sourdough. And so often that's the way that we approach cooking. We think it's all about the results. It needs to look and feel and be a certain way or we failed. And then when that inevitably happens, we feel terrible about ourselves. We feel bad about ourselves. We feel like we wasted time and money and all these kinds of things. And that's just, it's a bit of a setup because we're always going to have those experiences. We're always going to have times, often, you know, more times than more than not, we're going to have something that doesn't turn out well. And we need to have a way of normalizing that and also of appreciating ourselves in those moments too. You know, this whole week has been really busy for me and I haven't eaten like a regular meal. Like I ate a bagel over multiple hours, like half when it was fresh, and then another half later, and then I like shoved some nuts into my mouth in between. And I was starting to think, oh, what am I doing? I'm not taking good care of myself. And then I thought about it. I was like, no, I'm doing exactly what I need to do for this moment in time, because our lives are so imperfect. They're so messy. They're real life. And when home cooking is about cooking around our real lives, you know, they're not restaurant kitchens. They're not TV shows. They're not magazines. And we need to have standards that are really appropriate to our lives. And that's the kindest, I think, thing we can do for ourselves.
Yeah, we don't suddenly become Julia Child and get to work in this zone where it's like whatever time it takes, it'll get done. The fact is,
right,
our lives are still going.
Julia
Child famously
made mistakes too, right? Like she would always drop something and go, oh, it's part of the adventure. Like, true.
So how is this book organized? You got recipes, sure, but what else?
Yeah, I have a ton of essays, really, sort of about these experiences in life. And it's also kind of an unusual setup because, you know, most cookbooks are sort of like appetizers and breakfast foods and desserts and mains and that kind of thing. But we kind of have this section of it. We have good enough preparation, which is like acknowledging that so much of cooking is actually, you know, deciding what to eat and going shopping and figuring out all of that, which is so, you know, takes a lot of intellectual work, actually, and physical work. And then there's sort of good enough mornings, midday, and weeknights. So it's sort of about getting through your day. And the rest of it is about getting through your life. So it's about cooking good enough when you're struggling, good enough when you're ready to have fun, and then cooking for yourself. And then lastly, actually cooking for others, which is so much of what we tend to focus on when we think about cooking is about having dinner parties and hosting others. But I think that's almost like the last thing we want to do. It's like that, you know, we want to put on our own oxygen mask first, right? Like once we know how to look after ourselves, then we can really begin to look after others too.
Obviously, people can race through a cookbook and go, yeah, nope, 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 nope. Yeah, hey, this one looks good, but still, you know, you have to read a recipe. So you have a TLDR thing atop each recipe. Talk about that.
I do. Yes, thank you for that. Yeah, TLDR comes from the tech world, and it stands for too long, didn't read. So it's really, which is a really sort of funny way of putting it. But it's just this normal, you know, everyone tells me that they don't read recipes before they start. And I also have to admit that I frequently do the same thing. We know that it's the best practice, and it really is. Like, it's great if you can read a recipe fully before you begin, because you'll just know what you need to have, and you'll feel a little bit more calm during the process. But realistically, people are still not going to do it. So I wanted to provide just a really two-sentence version of the recipe so people would know what they were about to do and feel sort of comforted by that, as well as sort of acknowledge that it's okay and that this cookbook author, at least, is not judging them for not reading the whole recipe, too.
Well, for example, surprisingly awesome quesadillas I just opened up at random. The TLDR is cook chorizo and zucchini. Top each tortilla with the filling and cheese and fold it over. Cook in a pan until brown on both sides. Repeat.
Exactly. And that's fundamentally, what I also love about it is it also simplifies. It's like, that is actually all you're doing. Like, I break the process down further, of course, in the recipe so that you can feel really guided. But at the same time, that's fundamentally all you're doing. And if you know how to do that, you could even make the recipe just from that. Because so often I think people think, oh my gosh, what does making a chili must entail, you know, so many steps, and it looks like so many steps because it's all written out so clearly, but it's like, basically, take a bunch of vegetables and chop them up and open some cans of things and put them all in one pot and let it cook for a while. You know, like that's really so much of what we're doing is really very simple. And I think there's a beauty in acknowledging that. And I think there's something very comforting and validating about sharing that with people that, you know, I think sometimes it, as in the cooking or in the food world, it's like we kind of want to be grandiose, like, oh, look at all these amazing things we make. It almost make it seem harder than it is. And when it's actually really very simple. And then on the other hand, I think sometimes we can do the opposite where we can say, oh, it's really simple. And oh, it's not always so simple. It's really dependent on your skill level, your comfort level in your own kitchen, where you're at. And yeah, we all kind of just have to figure out our own path.
I do recommend when you commit to doing the recipe, do read all the way through so you don't get to the place where yes. people have gotten in some recipes. What do you mean I have to strain the butter?
Right, but that's also what the TLDR sort of does. Mm-hmm. Is I put everything in there that is like, if you have to leave it overnight, you know, to rise. Yeah. It's like, that's in the TLDR, so don't worry, you're not going to miss that. Mm-hmm.
All right, so let's talk about you. List 8 steps here from deciding what to eat to storing leftovers, and grocery shopping is obviously a part of this, which you have a really interesting take on this. People, it seems like, are always checking what's in each other's carts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We all judge each other, I think. I know it's sort of, not to get too sort of intense about it, but it really, if you can stop yourself from doing that, do. Because anytime we're judging someone else's food choices, ultimately we're making everything, we're probably judging ourselves too. Food choices are not like moral. Somebody else's food choices being different than yours, you have no idea what's going on in somebody else's life. And I think the thing is, often it can be harmless to judge someone else's food choices, but it also is harmful a lot of the time too. I know, when I was sort of working with Good and Cheap and around a lot of folks who are living on food stamps, is very frequently other people's judgments around what somebody who's on public assistance getting food stamps, what they were using their food stamps for, people would use that as an excuse to say, oh, you don't deserve to be, you know, receiving this assistance because you're buying something that I don't approve of. And that's just really profoundly unkind and shaming and cruel, ultimately. And I think that kind of thing, you know, there's versions of that that are, of course, not as cruel, but it does take, sometimes it can be really, really nasty. And I think we just want to be careful about that, because it's also for ourselves. It's like, if we're being judgmental about others, usually we're just as judgmental, if not more so, with ourselves. And it just does not serve us.
It reminds me of a discussion we had with Matthew Desmond, the author of the book Evicted, a few years ago. And one of the people he talked to said, yeah, I have lobster maybe once a month. And you know what? What am I waiting for?
Yeah, this
you know,
is my
I will
one
eat
life.
Ramen on the back end of the month for sure. But it's like, what am I waiting for? Until I get wealthier? It's not going to happen.
Exactly. Exactly. You have no idea what is going on in someone's life. It's just like anytime, like it's always just better to be kind. And what does it serve us to judge someone? It just makes us feel ultimately disconnected from them, I think, and feel like we're somehow set apart. And I think that's tempting because it can make us feel superior, which maybe sometimes can feel like a good feeling. But feeling superior isn't true. Like, we're all equal. Like, that's the truth. All human beings are equal. And we all come from different circumstances and different situations. And when we take the time to actually understand what somebody else is going through, I think that actually enriches our life. But when we instead judge it and assume that we know what's going on, we rob ourselves of the opportunity to connect.
Leanne Brown is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her latest book is called Good Enough, a cookbook, embracing the joys of imperfection and practicing self-care in the kitchen. And to that point, I think I breathed a little easier upon reading Let Go of the Outcome. This is, just to reiterate what you've already said, this is not about final results. You can have fun along the way.
100%. In fact, at least for me, that's where so much of my pleasure in cooking comes from, is when I'm actually making the food. I love the experience of, you know, getting into my senses. You know, we spend so much, I think, or at least I do, and I think many of us spend a lot of our working life up in our heads, you know, on computers, talking, really in our brains. And cooking is actually, yes, of course, we're using our brain, we're doing one step at a time, but we're also very much in our body, in our senses. And so when we cook, we can enjoy the smells that we're creating, you know, as we cut into, say, a lemon, the way that it squirts its juice out and suddenly the smell fills your nose, and also you feel the wetness on your hands, and it actually sometimes even like gets into your cuticles and hurts for a moment because it's citric
right.
acid and,
yes.
And you just feel alive, and you know, you hear the sound of something bubbling or sizzling, and you can just be there. And I think that often many of us, and I again include myself in this because I've often been known to be very anxious and results oriented when I'm cooking. When I'm in that state, I'm off in my head and I'm missing all of that lovely sensory experience. And when I'm missing it, I'm also not able to be there to actually notice, like, what is it that will really make you sort of a good cook, like make something really nicely, is if you're actually present to notice it and to use your senses. And we know that the more calm we are, the more we can use our senses, the more regulated we are. Our heartbeat is calm and our breathing is slow. And then we can actually be there to do our best with making the food and notice, oh, that smells good. Maybe I can add a little more of that. And now I can taste that. And to just really be in your senses. And it's just, it's healing. It's a really beautiful thing. And then the bonus to that is that if you can get into that space, there's almost sort of meditative space where you're not thinking so much, you're doing, you're being, you're here now. You can bring that energy if you're feeding others, if you're feeding your family or your friends. You can bring that energy to the table and to the conversation and to connecting rather than what often happens, which is this anxious energy of, oh, I just did a lot in the kitchen and I was thinking about a million things and now here I am and please like it. And it's not actually so connecting. Whereas sometimes if we slow down, take our time, make something simple, we actually allow ourselves the sort of luxury of being able to connect with others. And that's exactly what we want food to do. We want it to feed us and we want it to help us kind of connect with ourselves or others. And I think that's what allows us to have that in most of our daily lives. You know, there are times where you might spend hours in the kitchen and really, really try to, you know, make something special. And that's what you want to do. And that's how you want to spend your time. But I think when it comes to sort of weeknight cooking, I think we want to be simpler and do less, frankly, in order to de-stress ourselves and allow ourselves kind of just the grace to be here and to be doing enough.
Leanne Brown is our guest once again on the Jefferson Exchange, talking about her book of essays and recipes, Good Enough, A Cookbook, Embracing the Joys of Imperfection and Practicing Self-Care in the Kitchen. If you'd like to join our conversation and talk about the ways that you approach cooking and eating and some revelations you might have had along the way, or have some questions for Leanne, join us at 800-838-3760 by phone or send an email to jx@jeffnet.org. Naturally, you start us off in the recipe section with breakfast, but this is after an essay on you and mornings, and this is not your happy time, I gather.
No, it's not. I've always been jealous of morning people. It seems so nice. I'm not a morning person, and not only am I, you know, I feel kind of bleh in the morning, like emotionally, but I'm not hungry. Like, I have a little bit of an upset stomach, and so it has been hard. It's something I've really been trying to work with, and I found that the most helpful thing for me was just to accept that it's actually just okay for me to not feel great in the morning. I think for the longest time I was just like, come on, Leanne, you gotta get over this and that kind of thing. And it's like, well, that's just not how I'm built. I'm not much of a morning person. And so once I sort of learned to accept that it's okay that I don't feel great and know that even though maybe my body's sort of signals are not saying that I'm hungry, that it's still a good idea to eat. I began to just eat simple foods in the morning and try to feed myself. It's just become a really powerful practice for me to give myself care. And I think also to notice that it's harder to care for yourself or when you don't feel great about yourself. It really, really is. It takes so much more energy. And so sometimes the work then is in doing what you can to begin to notice, like, I am lovable even when I don't feel good. Mm-hmm. I deserve care even when I don't feel good. And in fact, more so when I don't feel good. And that if I can just be consistent with myself, make sure, you know, I've got some granola from last night, I'm going to eat that. And just have faith, have trust that after I eat that, I will begin to actually move through the day and start to feel better. And it almost always works. That's the thing. And the more frequently you sort of build that trust, with yourself, or for me anyway, it's about sort of building trust with my body and going like, yep, I know we feel bad in the morning, that's okay, but we're still going to go feed ourselves and start going and hope for better. And usually it does shift, you know, and I begin to sort of connect and notice, oh, being alive is actually pretty cool, and look at this neat work that I get to do, and I get to hug my lovely kid and, you know, walk her to school and wave at another parent and just, yeah, everything's going to be okay.
Well, you know, one of the recipes is interesting because it kind of belies the whole, you know, hustle and bustle of trying to get out the door in the morning thing. And honestly, I never thought of cooking scrambled eggs on the lowest heat.
Yeah. Oh, you have to try it. It's so nice. They're so, I feel like that's, thank you for mentioning that recipe because it's one of my favorites because it's so magical. And it works so well. It's the strangest thing. When you cook it on really, really low heat, the eggs end up so perfectly rich and smooth, and they sort of develop just this incredible texture, and you barely have to do anything. You can go off and shower and sort of do your whole thing while your eggs are cooking, and then you come back, you know, you occasionally stir it around just to see what's going on. And then eventually, you know, in 20 minutes or half hour, whatever sort of amount of time you have, you will have a warm breakfast, and it just feels so luxurious, and it's one of my favorite practices. I also think, I used to not be this way in my early 20s, especially in my mid-20s. I was like, I loved to have something different every day, sort of for every meal. But as I've gotten older, I've really embraced just sort of having the same breakfast frequently, because it's actually so comforting, at least for me anyway. And again, everybody is different, but I think there's something so nice about having that little thing to look forward to. I really like making those scrambled eggs. It feels like this lovely little ritual that I get to have. It's like making my coffee every morning sort of slowly and then putting on my eggs to cook in the background. It's just like, look at this.
Yeah, that's creamy hands-off scrambled eggs. And I wanted to ask, too, about the falling in love breakfast dish. Tell us about the delicate dill and cheddar omelet.
Oh, sure. So that one is, yeah, another egg dish. Ooh, that is my, here, I'm just going to flip to it, too. The delicate dill and cheddar omelet. So this is from sort of my early memories. This is in my early 20s, and I was still living in Canada. I used to, on Saturdays, we would go to the farmer's market, and we were, like, young, and we were admittedly, like, often hungover. So I would, like, yes. And I would get, like, a little carrot juice, and then we'd go home, and I'd make this, like, dill and cheddar omelet. And it was really a time when I was beginning to fall in love with cooking and just fall in love with this experience of making food for us, and I just felt so empowering to kind of have my own thing. I think it was one of the first things that I could think of that where it's like, oh, this is kind of my own recipe, a dill and cheddar omelet. I mean, it's not like it's groundbreakingly incredible, but it really was sort of something that was very much to our taste, sort of in our community. We got this lovely dill from the farmer's market, and we got these gorgeous fresh eggs, and it felt like I was in touch with my community. It made me feel really special. And of course, it was also when I met my now husband, and we were also falling in love. So I think that's a big part of it as well. But yeah, I mean, that, thanks for mentioning that, because I think food also is, and many people have talked about this more eloquently than I can, but food is so associated with memories. And when we smell something, when we eat something that we may have eaten with someone we love or at some certain time in our life, that memory can kind of come up and be with us.
Yeah, even the textures and, you know, like the greasiness of the pizza, you know, these kinds of things linger long after
right.
The taste of the meal is long gone.
Right.
I want to ask, before I get to the break, about your set for the week granola. And this sets a trend in the book of doing some extra time one day to save time on other days.
Yeah, I think that, again, and this is sort of me, my, like, grown-up Leanne kind of going, you know what, I'm okay with doing less and kind of setting myself up. And so I think of that really as, like, a gift you're giving your future self. And also, this is actually advice that I will often give. There's a lot of people who say, like, oh, I'm just so tired when it comes time to make dinner. I feel like that's the worst time of day for me to, like, have to do a whole new task. And if that's really how you feel, you know, we should listen to our rhythms. Just like I accept that I'm not a morning person, if you're exhausted at the end of the day, it may not be a great idea for you to be cooking a whole meal right after work. And so embrace, like, the slow cooker, or, like, doing things in advance so that you have that food. And so that you're doing the labor, the work, at some point when you do have energy. And then it's okay to sort of embrace your own rhythms in order to serve yourself. And I think that one of the best ways to do that is to make things in advance. And for me, making breakfast is really important because that's when I'm lowest energy.
Mm-hmm. We got a phone call on the line. Let's go to Sakachi in Eugene. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi there. I was telling the screener that brought back memories you're talking about cooking and learning to cook. My Italian grandmother lived to be 98 and was cooking to the end, and I asked her a year or two before she passed away what her secret was to a good long life. She said, keep cooking and keep smiling. And she made it a practice to teach every one of her 25 grandchildren and great-grandchildren to cook with her. She didn't think cooking was something you did on your own. My aunts tended to, who were good cooks, wanted nobody else in the kitchen. Uh-huh. But my grandmother wanted all the kids in the kitchen helping her cook. Do you have any good recipes to teach young children how to cook and enjoy food?
Oh, excellent question, and thanks for sharing the story, Vince. Good to hear from you.
Right.
I love that, and I'm so with your grandmother in that I think so much of it is just being around the cooking. And, you know, yes, I love something I make with my daughter. My daughter's four, and she's been sort of cooking with me, sitting beside me in one way or another since she was born. And now I would say we're going through a phase where she's really into baking because she can measure out the ingredients, and there's a lot for her sort of little hand to do. And she, because we're still not into the point where I'm really wanting her to chop too much. We have these little plastic knives that we work with, but it's still, she gets frustrated easily by how long that takes. So we tend to sort of do a lot of baking together. We'll make, we love to make pancakes. But even, for example, when we make her lunch for school, she always wants to do it with me. And I think it's because it's like your grandmother, I think it's so important to bring her into the process and show her that, I guess it's so much of what I've been talking about, that food, it's not all about the outcome. It's that the process of cooking is actually a way that we can connect, and it can be enjoyable. And so my daughter, Io, and I, we really connect when we cook together. I really try to not worry so much about getting it on the table. I try to take some deep breaths about, you know, she's spilling flour on the counter and on the floor, and I try to just, she is learning, this is a part of it, and just allow for all the messiness of that, because then we can really connect. And almost always, you know, after we've spent even, you know, 10 minutes together in the kitchen, maybe like making a snack, like making a little quesadilla for her or something, we'll just both be smiling and happy and connected because we did something together. We created something together. And I think that can only lead to just a really healthy relationship with food. And we also laugh. Like I say, I have to be careful because I, you know, I like things to be clean. And so when it's a little messy, it can be, I do have to take a deep breath, but I feel so proud that also it's every time we do that, I'm teaching her, you know, she'll go, oh, and she always says, it's okay to make mistakes. Haha, here, let's clean it up together. And we say these things, and it's just like all of that good stuff is going into her, and we're enjoying it. And she loves, my other favorite thing, which I think is such a great practice, is she loves to taste everything as it goes in, literally. Like, she has actually tasted, like, raw cinnamon before.
Ah, wow.
And regretted it, regretted it. But she loves to taste a little bit of everything. And, you know, rather than, you know, maybe some part of me is sometimes like, oh, you're going to spoil your appetite. But I think it's such a beautiful drive, you know, that she has this curiosity to try everything and taste everything. And she's usually so invested in the food that we make, in the outcome of it, that she'll almost always try it and even declare that it's delicious and then not eat any more of it, which is, you know, because sometimes she doesn't really like it, but she wants to like it because we made it together.
Oh, wow.
So I love cooking with her.
Does she have a wider, does Io have a wider range of things she likes than a lot of kids her age because of the exposure?
I don't know that she does. You know, that's just not for, like, young kids, like, especially, like, 4 to 6 or 7, sort of, or 3, I think, to 6 or 7 zone, are really tough because they have a super strong disgust response because of, it's actually, like, an evolutionary thing. It's because back in the day, they would have been old enough to sort of go out and get their own food for themselves, and we want to make sure they don't poison themselves. So they are sort of trained to only eat the foods that are so familiar. So sometimes, you know, on the one hand, yes, like, she does eat a wide variety of things, but on a given day, will she eat a variety of things? No. Like, some, it's like, yesterday you loved this, and today you hate it. Like, that's just what it is to feed a child, and you just can't take it personally. And you have to believe that they'll grow out of it, because we all did, right? We all eat a much wider variety of foods than we did as children, and that's fine.
So the idea of kids in the kitchen with grown-ups, mm-hmm. we have a regular food segment once a month on the third Friday with Will Smith, a local food stylist who shares some great stories about being in the kitchen with his grandmother, like what Vince mm-hmm. shared with us. Was anybody in your life like that for you? Did your mother, grandmother, somebody take, or are you just the cooking sheep in the family?
My parents both cook. My mom was more the, like, regular, everyday cook, and she's always really liked cooking, and she's a very good cook. And then my dad was more of, like, these sort of big, sometimes very weird projects. I remember very distinctly when I was a kid, him getting into tapping birch trees to make syrup for a while, and, like, just doing all these sorts of bigger projects.
Did somebody tell them they come from Maples?
Yeah, it's like we're in this part of Canada where there aren't maple trees, and I think Dad was just like, we need to have syrup somehow here. It was not the most successful of his things, but it was really fun at the same time. And I think, you know, all of that taught me that that there was something fun in the kitchen, but I actually think it was more that my parents were pretty strict about what we ate, whereas there was at some point, I think 10 or 11, I sort of asked if I could make something myself. And my parents said, sure, you can make, you know, whatever you want. And so I was like, oh, could I make, you know, like a dessert? And so I, like, would make a chocolate cake or something. And I began to, when I got to spend time actually on my own, choosing and making food for myself, I just found it so empowering. It was like, I get to be creative. I get to, it made me feel a little bit grown up. It made me, and I was just thrilled by how kind of easy it was. It made me feel really free. And I think that was definitely, like, set the groundwork. And then I just loved cooking. I became a vegetarian when I was 13. And that was also when I started to really take over cooking more of my own meals, just to kind of prove to my parents I wasn't going to make their lives difficult with my with my choice. And yeah, and then from there, I think I always just loved, it's funny, I've always loved cooking for others, but my favorite thing is I love to tell them how they could make it themselves, because I always want to dispel the sort of myth that what I did was really, like, incredibly difficult or magical. It's really just a series of simple steps almost always. Mm-hmm.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because there are some things you do in here that I would not have thought about. I mean, I'm just getting a little more experimental with cauliflower, it turns out. So my eyes latched onto the cauliflower cheese pita sandwich, and I just never thought of, I never thought I'd salivate for cauliflower in this way.
Good. Yeah, I mean, cauliflower really soaks up flavor, and it can get so wonderfully crispy. There's, like, so many little edges that can get crispy, too. So it's a fun one to play with. I'm glad that it has been, you know, having its culinary day, actually for quite a few years now. It's become popular with, like, cauliflower rice and all kinds of lovely things that are made from cauliflower now.
So, that's in the lunch section of the book, which is, and I should point out too, again, that this is about, you're good enough to take a little more time. So you don't advocate just grabbing something at your desk, it sounds like.
Well, I do advocate when that's what you need to do. But I think also if you notice that that makes you feel kind of lousy, if you can try to carve out a little bit more time for yourself, I think that's great. I know I have this lovely close friend of mine who's been telling me, she's been sending me a message, like, every week or so for a while now, saying, like, I was channeling you and your message when I, you know, I got up from my computer and I got myself some food. I was going to just not take a break, and I chose to go and take a break and get myself some food. And there's nothing that makes me happier than hearing that. So I think I think it's always about forgiving yourself. Like, sometimes you don't have time and you do need to do something at your desk. And when that's the case, you know, that's okay. But when you do, to definitely give yourself a break, because you won't accomplish more when you don't take breaks. We accomplish more when we do rest enough. Like, the biggest myth that I feel I have to unlearn is always like, don't take a break, just power through, it'll accomplish more. And it's like, we usually accomplish less that way because we burn ourselves out faster.
Yeah, and the quality of the work is not that great too, I want to point out.
Exactly, yeah, by the end of the day.
So while we're still in the a lot of salads in the lunch section of the book, including the how to get a girlfriend salad, so that, which raises the question, how instrumental was Dan's cooking in the firming up of your relationship?
Oh my gosh, it was not. Yeah, actually, famously, like one of our very first dates, he tried making me jambalaya, and he put like liquid smoke in it and gave himself, it was like we were supposed to go, we had some cool, like some journalist was talking at our university and like we were going to go to it, and he invited me over like a half hour before we were supposed to leave, and he was like, oh, I haven't started making the jambalaya yet. And so he started making this dish that takes like an hour and a half, like half an hour before we have to leave, and like it's taking, anyway, it, needless to say, it was not good. And I was not falling in love with him for his meal-making prowess, but for his many other wonderful qualities.
All right, so this brings us to evening meals anyway, and it's here in the book. Again, the book is titled Good Enough, that you argue that perfection is a liar.
Yeah.
What do you mean there?
I mean, perfection actually doesn't exist. Like, especially when it comes to food. Like, perfection... I mean, I'm almost tempted to read a little bit from that essay.
Sure.
Because good enough, it's like perfection is a fantasy. Like, basically, whenever someone says, oh, it's not perfect, it's like, well, is it, like, let's look at, say, a sourdough, because I think I said that earlier, like a perfect sourdough. It's like, whose standard? And then there's all these other things to bring through it. Like, did you do it quick enough? Is it, you know, is it round enough? Is it fluffy enough? Like, all these other things. Whereas when you do have a more reasonable standard, like good enough is literally just what can you do on a good, on a day? And it takes into account not just this outside standard, but also what works for you, because that's what really, really matters. I think of good enough is like an appropriate sort of standard, whereas perfection is like this fantasy that you'll never actually achieve. And so you'll never actually feel good about yourself and never feel like you're winning. Whereas when we say, hey, whatever I can do, whatever works for me today, that is what's good enough. Then you can like let it go and just feel like everything is okay.
So don't beat yourself up for not delivering
some
great meal.
Exactly. And I think good enough also is about, it's about the food. It's also about ourselves. Like, it's really going like, I'm good enough, and not internalizing these, like, if I've done, when we sometimes behave in ways that we're not proud of, or we sometimes don't accomplish something that we're not proud of, we so often are taught to like internalize that as though that has something to do with you and your identity. And it doesn't. It has nothing to do with who you are. We are always good enough no matter what. No matter what you're eating, no matter where you're at in life.
So, Leanne, we're down to our last minute, and I do find myself wondering, given the great changes in your life, you know, you have IO now and so much else going on, and you couldn't eat for 9 months while you were pregnant, you point out.
I did eat. Had to eat,
yeah,
but it was not pleasant.
9 months of nausea. Blah. So, could you have envisioned this book when we last talked in August of 2015?
No, there's no way. I mean... No, that's why I look back and I really feel so proud of this book, because it's really just, it's from my heart. You know, this is what I needed to hear, and it's what I hope will bring. The biggest thing I hope that this brings comfort to others, the way that it really genuinely comforts me to know this. It allows me to sort of relax and let go of so much stuff every time I read these books and this message that I'm good enough.
Well, you can just read the essays and that would be good enough. And you can just read the recipes and that would be good enough. But they're all together in one big thing. It's called Good Enough, a Cookbook, Embracing the Joys of Imperfection and Practicing Self-Care in the Kitchen by Leanne Brown, who joined us for Good and Cheap back in August of 2015. Leanne, just a pleasure to have you back on again. Thanks so much.
Thank you. That was lovely.
All right. Take care.